good afternoon and welcome to the town square. I was almost going to say the conversation there for a second. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and as we tell you every week, these conversations include you. And if you'd like to be part of tonight's discussion, you might want to write down these numbers in advance. 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, use that number. From the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, you can reach us at 877-941-3689. And we'll also remind you of those numbers again during the program. Now, according to a project of the British daily newspaper, The Guardian, and solely based on 2016 data, Hawaii has something in common with New Mexico, Arkansas, South Dakota, the District of Columbia, Oklahoma, Alabama, Arizona, Colorado, and Wyoming. Hawaii is in the top 10 states with the highest per capita number of people killed by police. New Mexico is the worst state. Hawaii currently ranks ninth. Our overall ranking stands at 32, but last year Hawaii ranked 39th. In 6 months, Hawaii jumped 7 places toward the states with the worst records of police shootings. Now, that sounds pretty grim, but we're going to put that into some context. Certainly, the police shootings in Baton Rouge and Minneapolis and the officers shot and killed in Dallas mean that many communities are now looking at their own community police relations. That includes in our state. And today on Town Square, our panel will look at what more the state, counties, police departments, and citizens can do to strengthen the community relations, and we want to hear from you. Now, again, our number is 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, use that number. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Now to our panel. Around the table are Senator Willis Sparrow. He's the vice chair of the Committee on Public Safety. He is a key advocate of police and prison reform. Aaron Hunger is a former police officer serving in Miami and California, now a criminal justice instructor and researcher at UH Manoa, finishing his PhD. He helped to craft some of the legislative effort on police accountability. And rounding out our panel from the Honolulu Police Department is Captain Roddy Vanek. He's assigned to Chief Kealoha's office. And of course, you're here too, 941-3689. Or 877-941-3689. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for making time for this.
Aloha.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We've watched so much violence over the last couple of years, and the last week in particular, that as many communities are looking to themselves to figure out how do they characterize their own relationships with their police departments, ours looks a little bit different. Despite all of the issues that we've had with police, despite not having maybe full access to a lot of paperwork, a lot of documents, and cases that have been in the news, but we still are very, very different. I'd like to go right around the table and just get from you how you characterize our community relationship in Hawaii with our various police departments, just very quickly. And Senator, I'll start with you.
Well, our Honolulu Police Department is very active and engaged in the community, and they reach out. And I've been involved in many programs like Weed and Seed, DARE, PAL, Neighborhood Watch, KKID. So we have a big city with a small town atmosphere. And, you know, people know each other. They have neighbors and friends and relatives who are in the police department. And overall, what we have here is much different than big city USA comparable in our size. We do have some issues and problems we need to deal with, but, you know, we are relatively safe, and I think right now we're making progress in improvements.
Aaron Hunger.
So as a scientist and as a former police officer, I would agree that you have a unique model here. Whereas you do have a modern police department that has to respond to urban, modern types of crimes, while at the same time appearing to be very tourist-friendly and very small-townish when it comes to the individual communities that it responds to. That said, it's caught in a conundrum from having to deal with national crises and national policing efforts like counterterrorism in a tourist community. To dealing with small town incidents like traffic incidents or homicides that happen within the community. So you have a department that's been forced recently to modernize fairly quickly. And with growth comes some different types of flexing of what we need in terms of laws as a community. So we're reacting as well as a national stage to local demands. And that, I think, is playing out legislatively and as we adjust our community to meet the needs of or adjust our police to meet the needs of our new communities.
Captain Vanek.
Thanks. Hi. You know, I think if you're asking what the current state of police-community relations are here in Hawaii, I'd say that it's actually pretty good. You know, in comparison to a lot of places on the mainland, we don't see the same type of cultural rift and cultural tension that a lot of places on the mainland are experiencing. And I think that leads to a lot of the types of relationships that we have with our community. You know, although it's good, we're always trying to improve, and there's always room for improvement. But definitely we have a lot of programs, I feel, that we're making an effort in and on. I think another thing, getting back to the cultural diversity part, is that our officers here are made up of a lot of different or come from a lot of different ethnicities and cultural backgrounds. Unlike places in the mainland that maybe have some departments that are predominantly white, working in a place with a lot of African-American people, here in Hawaii, we have a lot of officers that are of all different races and backgrounds, and they're working and in the place where they live, some of them. I mean, they're driving a couple of miles, and they're working in places literally down the street from where they live. And also, they're active in their communities. They're coaches, Sunday school teachers, community leaders. So I think because of that cultural diversity and that cultural mix that we see not only in the community but in our police force, that really helps with the community police relations that we see here in Hawaii.
You've heard what our panelists have to say. We'd like to hear from you. How do you view community relations between your community, wherever you are, and the police force? Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We like to think of ourselves in a certain way in Hawaii, that somehow we are not exactly beyond racial tensions because we know that we have them, but that we deal with them in a different way. And yet they're still there and they're still simmering under the surface. Do you think we really have the kind of racial tensions that we don't talk about and should a lot more? Despite the fact that we know that we are ethnically diverse.
Mm-hmm.
There are still those simmerings that happen. Do we need to talk about this more?
You know, I think no matter where you are, Hawaii is not immune to a lot of the problems that cities on the mainland are experiencing. But I think maybe the degree of which we're experiencing them because of the cultural diversity is not as intense. That's not to say that it doesn't happen here in Hawaii, but I think the maybe the problem, if I could say, that exists in other places in the mainland aren't as magnified here in Hawaii because of the cultural diversity and the type of really spirit of aloha that we have here in Hawaii that you find nowhere else on earth, basically.
Right. The fact that all ethnic groups here basically are minorities, we don't have any one dominant group, helps our situation. However, certainly, you know, you sometimes hear the comment regarding Caucasians or Haoles or most recent immigrants like Micronesians and in other years maybe Filipinos or Samoans. But we have a very high level, in my opinion, of tolerance and respect. Especially, you know, coming from an Asian Pacific angle or majority background, you know, respect of elders, respect of others. But certainly, I would say that there are probably some times that, yes, we can probably talk a little more about our differences and how we can continue to improve things in Hawaii, especially as our population continues to grow. We have limited land and space, and the potential of tensions as we become a city of, you know, Honolulu, for example, is about 1 million now. I predict in 50 years it'll be 1.5 million. In 100 years it'll be 2 million. And there's going to be many challenges that this is going to give our leaders and our citizens.
Aaron, given the fact that we know that the population is changing, you've got a lot of people moving here from elsewhere. The impulse that you've both talked about, or that you've all talked about in terms of how Hawaii may operate differently, that by its very nature is going to change. I mean, you're here, you're a transplant too, and you've observed some changes even in the time that you've been here, some of them for the better and some of them not. Every time we have a conversation about what it means to be, you know, Hale in Hawaii or anything else, we get lots of calls about people talking about the things that, you know, aren't so nice for us to talk about, but that are very real and breathing. How do you handle that when you're talking about that in the context of criminal justice?
So full disclosure to our radio audience, I am Caucasian and I am a transplant to the island. I was actually invited here by the University of Hawaii as a researcher, and that's what I've been doing. And so as a researcher, I can say that when it comes to criminal justice and criminal justice topics, oftentimes there are communities in the mainland, for example, the community that I'm from in Oakland, where police issues or criminal justice issues can be real polarizing to a community. And again, that's nationally we see the trend is over racial issues right now. There's a real racial polarization that's driving criminal justice topics. From a researcher's standpoint, that's not what happened, or that wasn't what happened here in the island that brought about a lot of the legislative reform. There was a driving catalyst and there were driving topics, but they weren't racially motivated, as you pointed to. The topics that drove and the catalysts that were brought up in the island were more gender related. And working in the University of Hawaii's Women's Studies Department, a lot of the academics that were working on police issues were feminists who were working with the Women's Legislative Caucus and other women's groups that were trying to bring about some type of attention to ongoing problems with women's violence and the police department itself. And that point was well made to the fact that we began to make legislation to address this perception of communal trust. I think the important thing that we need to somehow lead to is that the legislative efforts that resulted from that research and the police coming into the conversation and legislators getting involved and women's groups beginning to be really the advocates to educate the community was that legislation was created that was specifically designed to start rebuilding trust when it came to looking at incidents that police were involved in that dealt with deaths in the community. So police homicides or what we would call in custody deaths. That said, I think we stumbled on really a bigger topic that's being discussed nationally as it comes to these racial problems between communities and police of how to build confidence when it comes to police involvement with death in the community, police homicides. Here we've developed legislation. It has passed. The police were involved. The legislators were involved. Academics, women's groups.
You're talking about the External Oversight Board.
I'm talking. Yes, correct. In fact, Senator Sparrow was the original designer of this bill way back and had the foresight to work with a research project from UH that we were running under the Human Studies project in the Political Science Department that really looked at ways to try to build public confidence and rebuild community relations in Hawaii. And the senator sat down and worked with us through the entire legislative session to really start to rebuild these inroads. And that's where I think we really get to your question is, what is the big difference between police community relations here in Hawaii and those in the mainland? And I think at the end of the day, there's a greater sense of ohana in this community that I see as a transplant from the mainland that sometimes comes into play at critical moments that gives this community the ability to step back and take a deep breath and have perspective when they look at what needs to be done. And I know that this legislation, when we start talking nationally, may not be the tire that fits every community, but it is the legislation that's now passed that begins a starting point for discussion for many communities that are in crisis over exactly what you said, racial divides between police and their communities.
Captain Vanek, as you look at those racial divides, and I know that we wish that they weren't there, and in many cases people say we paper over them or we turn a blind eye, but there have been several cases in the last year where we've seen that you can't turn a blind eye when someone has clearly done something wrong on the force, and yet people don't know about what that might be. There's not enough transparency. There's been a lot of pushback from the media and from other organizations that Aaron just talked about. As you have internal dialogue, and as much as you can talk about it on the radio, how are you assessing some of these changes that seem to be coming, whether HPD kind of likes it or not?
Mm. I think, at the end of the day, when we talk about what legislation needs to be made and what changes, if any, we need to make as a department, the top priority is always about public safety and community safety. But I think what needs to be remembered is public safety and community safety can't only be done by the police department. Community members have to be involved. And although the department bears a majority of the responsibility, not only here in Hawaii, but worldwide, community safety is a partnership that needs to be formed with the people who live out there every day in the community and the police departments that work for them and who serve them. And I mean, look at just here in Hawaii. We have so many different types of programs that we're involved with. We have partnerships with all of these different organizations, and it's all in an effort to create these partnerships so that we can make Hawaii, one of the safest places in the nation.
But it seems that especially in very recent times, HPD in particular has come under the microscope quite a bit, and seems that it will continue to be that way, so that is not just a matter of let's create community partnerships, really looking at how HPD runs itself and very serious concerns about how that interplay happens in a way that is as transparent as it can be to everyone else, to be able to build that trust in the police department. That can't always be easy. Transparency always means that for those who want the transparency, they feel great about it. But for those who don't, then they feel that it's not a very good thing. Mm-hmm. So how is it that it's being assessed when you see that there's so much more focus happening now on HPD and how officers behave?
Transparency is one way that a department can move towards creating public trust. I know our department in recent years, we've had an opportunity to create more transparency. One way is that we've put all of our police HPD policies actually online. Before, I think nationwide, maybe that was something that's unheard of. Why would we want to reveal almost like our playbook to everyone? But I think to help develop that public trust that you're talking about, that's one of the things that our department decided to do. And I think that's just one example of, some of the things that we need to continue to look at and that we are continuing to look at in order to build public trust. Like how you said, public trust is key. And I mentioned before, in order to effectively do our job to keep everyone safe, we need to make sure that we foster that public trust.
All right, we're going to take a caller. If you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689-941-3689. If you're calling us from Oahu, use that number. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Do you trust the police department in your community? What would it take for you to trust them more? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Randy calling us from Ewa Beach. Aloha, Randy. Thanks for your patience.
Aloha. Thank you for taking my call.
A pleasure. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to say hello to the panel and Senator Sparrow as well. But my question comes kind of outside of Hawaii, since we don't have a huge issue here. But we see a lot of issues on the mainland of, the violence happening from officers as well. But have HPD, with your time at HPD, have you got training on de-escalation tactics? And do you think maybe that our police forces on the mainland can benefit from that? Myself, I'm a military veteran with multiple deployments, and that was a bulk of our training before we went overseas. And it seems a lot of the instances now are starts at a 9 and it ends fatal at a 10 and has never de-escalated from there.
All right, Randy, thanks very much for the question. De-escalation training.
Mm-hmm.
And we could talk about training just in general,
sure.
In terms of what protocols there are for the use of lethal force. That's the flip side of it.
Right. So our officers definitely have de-escalation training. And the Honolulu Police Department has a use of force continuum, as many police departments across the nation do. And we do train our officers on the type of appropriate force to use, which includes when it is appropriate and actually when it's necessary to de-escalate. So our officers definitely do receive that type of training.
How long is that training?
De-escalation training?
De-escalation,
or training in general?
Well, the de-escalation part of it, and then also the part that says, here's the protocol for using lethal force.
You know, I don't know enough to speak on the topic as far as how much training is dedicated to de-escalation training. But I do know that our training overall, in general, lasts 6.5 months once a recruit enters into the academy. After that, they go to what's called their field training and evaluation program, where they work one-on-one under direct supervision of a field training officer. And that's for another period of anywhere from 4 to 6 months. And even after that, after they've had that on-road experience, they go to what we call our fourth watch, where they have a supervisor who closely watches what they're doing, and they're still being evaluated at that point. So as far as training regarding police issues and evaluation and continuing our training, that's definitely something that the department has a high priority for. And also our incumbent officers are required every year to go through an annual recall training. So definitely training is something that the department places a high priority on.
Is there a way that you can talk a little bit more fully about what it looks like when you know that you have to use full force? Because the reason I ask mm-hmm. is because there are people who say, well, why do they have to just, center mass and do that? Why not
try
to wing them and just bring them down? I mean, people always say that.
Yeah.
And we hear that. I mean, I'm watching Aaron laugh at that, too.
Aaron, you want to take this one? I'm sure you can answer this.
So, again, I'm going to draw on my experience as a police officer for a long time. Again, I was licensed in Florida and I was licensed in California, where there were standards in training set by the state. I think that touches on one of Randy's topics. We don't have a standards board yet. I know that the senator's probably going to say that's one of his priorities in the upcoming legislative session, as we were really close this year to bringing all the parties together and reaching a resolution point. But greater to Randy's question about de-escalation training, there's a number of different things that are taught in the academy that surround de-escalation, including how to speak to people, what's known as interpersonal communications, and this also goes with scenarios where trainers actually look at the attitudes, the conduct, and the body language of the trainees. They try to adjust these things and bring attention to officers to say, maybe your intent is to say one thing, but the body language that you're putting forward really says something else to the person that you're talking to. And these types of things need to be brought out in the training. So when we talk about de-escalation training, it's more than just a class or more than just a singular process. De-escalation is part of what's taught in the academy as the overall mindset. You have to understand that when police get to these emergency situations, tensions are high. Emotions are raging in some cases. And police's job is to get the information. And so that naturally comes with having to de-escalate these crises. And in terms of the question that the public may ask, well, why do the police have to shoot at center mass? And again, This comes through years of research wherein police are reacting to situations. And when you react to something and you've decided that deadly force is the appropriate amount of force to use, I mean, you've made a huge decision in terms of the power that you're going to use that was granted to you by the public. This is, I mean, it's a huge responsibility.
And we should say you have some experience with this.
Both good and bad, you know, where I've had to come to that brink and never had to use it. And unfortunately, an incident where I did have to face a family in the aftermath and justify why their son was no longer around and what had happened. So these are important oversight tools to give the community the ability to understand that police don't act without some type of oversight.
Senator, I know you wanted to say something on that, and we have lots of callers, lots of people who want to talk to you guys.
I just wanted to briefly state that, yes, as Aaron mentioned, we do need statewide standards and training. And this is not just for the county police, but I'm talking about our state sheriffs, our harbor police, our airport police, our DLNR conservation officers, because it's not unusual for individuals to go from one agency to another. And we need to make certain that if there is this movement, that there's a certification so that these individuals are qualified to go from one agency to the next.
And, of course, that if there was something that were moving them from out of their current position that wasn't terribly savory, that that's also as transparent.
Yes, exactly. It's a way to also be able to checks and balance so we could see where there are problems, then that would also be red flagged.
All right. We're going to take some callers now. If you want to join us, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. But don't wait. If you want to get in on the conversation, call us sooner rather than later. Going now to James from Makiki. Aloha, James. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. I hate to break ranks with all the Emperor's New Clothes that I've been hearing from your panel, but I personally witnessed the use of deadly force on the Alawai, where a veteran was basically executed in an incident where it's my belief that if we had actual professional policing standards and training, that the situation could have been resolved much more peacefully. I think, in general, over my lifetime, I've seen the police over the whole country go from a standard of community policing to an increasingly socially engineered, more militaristic profile, to the point where if I get pulled over by the police, I'm terrified that there's going to be an incompetent person with a two-digit IQ armed to the teeth and ready to just draw down and gun me down for no reason. I'll take my comment off the air.
All right, James. Thanks very much for the call. I mean, as we said, depends upon what your experience is and what you've seen and who has been with you,
right,
when you have experienced that. And in his case, seeing what he saw obviously is going to leave, right, a great impression.
Yeah, and James, no one here is saying that there are no problems, and no one's saying we can't improve. And I've got files of issues and concerns that need to be addressed. But we certainly go back to standards and training, recruitment, you know, training, supervision. That all needs to improve. For example, the educational requirement for an officer, and Captain, correct me if I'm wrong, is a GED. You know, I personally think we need to up that. And so sometimes the wheels of change occur slowly, but as long as you have individuals out here advocating and pushing, you know, in a very respectful way and in a way where we can all give our two cents and try to do what's best, I think we'll slowly make progress, and we certainly are, in my opinion.
Hearing what James had to say, I saw you wince a little bit at that. No one wants to talk about someone who was killed at the hands of police. And about that case in particular, if there's something that you want to say about that. But in general, when we see cases like this happen and not having a standards board, not having a sense that there is something that's unified in understanding, it certainly seems to thwart the ability to build trust and have that understanding within the greater, you know, greater community.
Mm-hmm.
As you look at this case that he brought up, mm-hmm. and others like this, how do you begin to make sense of that, given the fact that we seem not to have a unifier or a leveler when it comes to standards and training?
You know, I think as far as the standardization goes, that will or won't happen. I can tell you personally, and I know that the Honolulu Police Department in particular has a very high level and standards for training. We take our training of our officers and recruits very seriously. And you mentioned that I winced when I heard that case, and it's not necessarily about that case in particular, but, you know, when an officer is forced to use deadly force, or when they have to use deadly force, it isn't, like Aaron said, a decision that the officer makes lightly. It, in the officer's mind, it has reached that point where they feel that either their lives or the lives of the public is at risk, and that is the only option they have left. And taking a life, I mean, I don't have that personal experience, but I can only imagine that it's not something easy to do.
Where do we get our recruits? Do they mostly come from Hawaii, or are they imported from elsewhere?
We get a fair share from here locally, as well as from the mainland or other places. I think, as I mentioned before, that's part of the reason why we're not seeing some of the same problems that we see maybe on the mainland, is because of our cultural diversity and where our officers come from. We have officers from here, from the mainland, Japan, mm-hmm. Polynesia, Europe, Eastern Europe. So they come from all over.
Aaron, jump into this for a second, then we're going to go right back to our callers. The idea that you don't take a life and come to that point lightly. But there are still stories about people who believe that somehow there hasn't been enough training. And we hear a lot about this concerning cases on the mainland where someone didn't appear to have enough training. Why would they have to empty so many shots in that person? I mean, what we saw happen last week, bringing up all of those questions again about really what kind of protocol is there? Is there really a protocol that can be easily understood?
So James brings up some real good points. And I think that James really demonstrates sort of a national attitude that while on the one hand, people are forced to rely on police for their public safety, I think that nationally we can see, and this is not a local problem, this is a national problem, that there's been a loss of confidence in the professionalism of police and police professionalism. That said, there are things that can be done in training that help gear an individual to react to these moments in a way that might be one that calms them into not using deadly force initially. And so when we look and assess training, these are some of the tools we can look at it. How are we preparing these individuals for those moments of crisis? As of yet, again, we're relying on the counties to oversee themselves when it comes to how they're preparing these individuals. I believe that's where the senator really wants to work on a standardization of how are we preparing our law enforcement and public safety individuals for these crisis moments? What training is being given to them psychologically to prepare them for these moments where they may have to use this force? And I think that's where James says, look, you know, if there's no oversight as to what's being trained, then as a military person, how do I know that they're receiving the best training that, you know, we're getting in the military before we go overseas and deal with similar situations?
Where there are very, very clear protocols about things.
And that's where this legislation that the senator worked on with police and that we've just passed becomes this point of conversation for James and others to say, look, at least in Hawaii, we came up with law that says that there will be independent review of all police homicides.
Right. I mean, that, unfortunately, that's sort of the ex post facto side of it.
And the case that James talks about was one of the catalysts that brought the senator and I to this discussion prior to the early legislation, early legislative developments that ended up to be the law that we're now going to look at for an independent review board. So James's concern didn't fall on deaf ears. We actually took that moment and with the research brought it into this legislation. So we are addressing what James is concerned.
All right, we've got a lot of callers on the line. We're going to go back to the phone lines now to Jonah calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Jonah. Thank you for your patience. Jonah, you there?
Hi. Yeah, I'm here.
Jonah, can you please turn down your radio because we're getting a lot of backfeed and we can't hear you.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think it's the perfect time to chime in. I grew up here in Honolulu. I was born and raised here, and I actually have a question for the captain. And I'm currently pursuing a field in law enforcement here in Honolulu, and I feel like most of it is a challenge with the things that are going around in the nation, and especially the negativity that goes around HPD. But I don't feel it necessarily discouraged me personally. But I just wanted to know if he had any insight as to individuals that may have felt that they wanted to pursue a career in law enforcement, especially here in Hawaii, and then hearing all the, you know, everything that's going on, and maybe they're, they're at a loss of deciding on if they want to continue that field or not.
Okay, well, we'll answer that one pretty briefly for you. Thanks, Jonah. He's just saying, is there a lot of recruits that you've talked to who have sort of a loss of faith, or they are discouraged from pursuing what they thought they initially wanted to in law enforcement because of all of the publicity with what has happened with HPD, and or the idea that this is a calling, and if you're really committed, you're really committed to it. Hmm. How do you get to that point?
You know, first of all, I want to encourage you and thank you for applying, and I hope that, you know, you have an opportunity to one day work with me and I can work with you. But I'd like to point out that, you know, being an officer is a true calling. It's a tough job. A lot of times, officers leave their homes every day not knowing if they're going to return. And they are. They put their lives on the line each and every day, and it's an unselfish act to keep our community safe. As far as people being discouraged by what's going on, I hope not, you know. We're always looking for people. Anytime someone wants to make that type of sacrifice and give them themselves unselfishly like that, I applaud that effort, you know, and I think we need good people like that who are willing to make that difference in the community. I mean, as a matter of fact, right now we're in an open application period.
Pitch.
There you go. So, you know, if you are interested in applying for HPD, you can go online and look us up and definitely put in your application.
Really briefly, because we've got lots of calls on the line, but I've actually had some officers tell me confidentially that they were bad boys once upon a time.
Yeah.
And that this is their way of atoning and giving back. And that was a very important thing for them to become police officers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sense that there were, you know, a lot of bad boys running around there too who are also trying to do that?
You know, I'm not sure about bad boys. I think maybe everyone in their younger days may have been a little bit of kolohe or of a rascal. But you know, I think once you have that calling to become a police officer, your mindset changes. You're not doing it. You're doing it for the right reasons. You're
okay.
Out there to serve our community. And, you know, whether you're a bad boy or not before, you know,
but it can
you're doing it for different reasons now.
Help to understand some of the other bad boys and girls out there, too.
Yes.
And looking at it from a very different perspective.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to go to Roland calling us from Kalihi. Aloha, Roland. Thanks very much for your patience.
Oh, thank you. We should continue to encourage the police service because they're doing a great job. To me, they are really doing a great job. You know, there's not any institution that is not bad, not, but I can give them like 8 to 10%. They are really doing a good job, and we should continue encouraging them. That's the only thing I have for you guys.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Yeah.
Going to move now to Raul calling us from Waikiki. Okay. Jim in Kapa'au. Jimmy, are you there?
Yeah, aloha. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say, you know, thank you to the police. I know the majority of them are really great people, and they're putting up with a lot from, you know, the few bad apples that are out there, and they do. I just want to say thank you. But I also wanted to say I had a friend, he passed away, and he was a psychologist years ago in the 60s and 70s in New York City, and he was a psychologist for the NYPD. And he was telling me the job attracts some bad apples, people that would be classified as sociopathic, because of the power, the gun, the club, the badge. And I wonder what kind of psychological screening, and if there's a continuous screening that goes on as people's careers progress, you know, if they get burnt out, if they, you know, get, you know, because what we've been seeing, I mean, just this lethal force, unnecessary. To my eyes, it looks unnecessary. And
all right,
I'd
Jim.
Love to see.
Let me have the
my
panel.
My last encounter with an officer, I had already pulled over. There was some stuff blowing off the back of my trailer. And it was a young officer. And anyway, and so he's asking me where I live. And I used the P.O. box. And then he wanted to know. I didn't know my physical address off the top of my head and on the Big Island. And so I'm describing where I live. And he's like, oh, you live in the pasture? You know? And I just looked at him. I'm a totally mellow guy. And I said, do they teach you to be a smartass in police academy? Why do you got to act to me like that? You know, the guy's just shaking. He's like ready for action, and there's nothing going on. You know, it's just
too combative for this situation. Okay, let's have the panel talk a little bit about your question, because that sort of moves off back into the idea of what kind of training, what kind of screening, and what ongoing help is there when somebody's moving through a career and life changes and. You have incidents like this with rookies, and you have incidents potentially like this from people who've been on the force for a while. What kind of psychological screening have you both had, both you and Aaron, in that? Oh, stop laughing, Aaron. But really, because what he says is, you know, we hear stories like this. People will call us and tell us about their experiences with police officers, good and bad, and the sense that they're being challenged, and there's no reason to be combative.
So as a criminal justice instructor, I wanted to sort of address the last few calls. Number one, just to reassure some of the callers who are interested in policing that are sort of taken back by the national tone right now, I need to assure them that as a former police officer and as a researcher, in our society in the United States, this is a very cyclical process. It's not the first time in our society where we've seen police be the sort of the targets of critique by the community and for there to be a pushback and even violent pushback against police. And we've always sort of resolved these issues. And at the end of the day, we were making real inroads in the late 90s right up to 9/11 with community policing to sort of address some of the problems that we found in the 70s and the 80s. That led to violent pushback with police. So I would tell them, you know, don't be dissuaded from policing. It's still one of, you know, the most honored professions in terms of being seen as having integrity and being a critical part of society.
But to the point of being, you know, his question of who is attracted to this and how do you screen out those who could potentially become bad actors?
So that gets us to another caller. Just to assure him, I've gone through several processes of becoming a police officer, both in the federal government and locally. And through each of those problems, extensive psychological testing, both written as well as an interview, as well as an ongoing assessment through field assessment by the individual department, were all part of the psychological determination of whether that person gains permanent employment within the department. And even then, after critical incidents, the department requires officers to go through psychological counseling and testing to assure that person doesn't have some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder. And even if they don't show post-traumatic stress disorder, departments oftentimes still require officers to undergo counseling and treatment for a prolonged period of time to assess and ensure that there's no residual carryover.
Or what about the idea that, you know, someone is just power hungry and enjoys that?
So one of the things that the pre-screening or hiring is testing does through tests like the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Test and other very long tests is to see if a person is intentionally trying to manipulate the system who does exhibit these characteristics and can manipulate the test. And that's why there's multiple levels and multiple layers that a person must participate in to try to determine whether or not they exhibit these personalities. Now, that doesn't mean that people still don't get through, which is why we have internal affairs, which is why we have oversight, and which is why we have these stopgap mechanisms at the state level.
Okay,
but we should.
But because we have people asking about officers right here, right now, Captain Vanek, how would you answer him when he says, you know, this guy was just challenging me and he pulled me over? We hear that story a lot, and I'm sure you do too, with you know, people who just feel that an officer is being unnecessarily combative or authoritative in a way that is not called for in the situation.
Yeah, well, just first of all, to echo what Aaron said is, you know, during the screening process, we do have extensive psychological evaluations. And like he mentioned, throughout their career, if they're involved in a crisis situation or if they're involved in other types of situations, you know, we have resources within the department that officers can turn to for help, or we have procedures and policies that if we see an officer that displays certain types of behaviors, then that comes up as a red flag. And then we take certain steps to make sure that that officer then isn't out in the public and doing maybe things that they're not supposed to. So we have those mechanisms, like Aaron said, built in. As far as sorry, could you repeat your other question of
regarding what part of that?
The,
about being, oh, just unnecessarily combative.
Right, right.
We hear people who say, you know, it was a simple situation. I didn't need this officer to get in my face. It wasn't called for.
Right.
And I wasn't doing anything to provoke an officer, but he seemed to have an attitude. I mean, people have said that to us on more than one occasion. I'm sure you've heard that too.
And I think the same thing what Aaron said is, you know, generally speaking, and I think even the caller said that most of the time, a majority of officers are good. They're doing things for the right reason. You know, there's always a
it's not fail-safe. I mean, we
right,
know that.
Exactly. But I think what's important to remember is also that officers are out there generally. They have the right intentions. And I think also what we see out there in that's happening nationwide, remember now we're having officers being shot. We're having all of these tensions. Police work is a dangerous job. And officers sometimes when they go to a situation, they're coming in at a heightened sense of could maybe almost fear, right? So when they're approaching the situation, until they de-escalate the situation, they may be thinking, you know, how can this person that I'm dealing with possibly hurt me? Now, an officer, depending on who they are, may react to that in a different way. And some of that may come out as being overly aggressive. But, you know, that's always something that we as a department need to look at and work on in increasing the type of training that we do and making sure that our officers are acting appropriately and addressing each situation appropriately.
I just want to add, it's important to have strong leadership and strong management. And, you know, it starts with the chief, his deputy chiefs, his assistant chiefs, his managers. They set the tone. And other officers will pick up from them. And we need to make certain that our officers get the appropriate support they need because, as he stated, it is very stressful and difficult at times. But, you know, sometimes officers snap or, you know, do things that they don't. And we need to make certain that we have the training and the ability to try to identify those individuals before it does occur.
I think just if I could really fast, another thing to remember, too, is, you know, if the public does encounter an officer that is unprofessional or they feel that they've done something that they shouldn't have, you know, we have our what's called professional standards office, or I think people might know it as internal affairs, IA, or we have the police commission who they can send a complaint to, you know, so it's something. And when those complaints come in, it's something that we have our PSO look into. We look at it administratively. If there's criminal, something criminal that happened, we look at it at those things too. And you know, we hold our officers to high standards, and we expect them to act a certain way, and when they don't, there's consequences for those actions.
All right, I want to get a few more of our callers in. Aaron, very briefly.
Yeah, I'm just dying to get into this conversation. One of the things that our research found was that one of the tools that was not used by the community that does exist in terms of oversight to a great deal was the police commission. And we've been doing a lot of work with Senator Aspero, working with the police commission on ways that they can improve their position as an oversight tool. And there will be a ballot measure coming in November to allow Honolulu residents to empower the commission that we worked on as a tool to really empower the police department too, to use the commission as an oversight a resource.
Well,
and
I mean, that's been some of the criticism, that there really hasn't been enough teeth.
Actually, and what I found, quite honestly, is civilian oversight over our police departments is weak and poor. It really is. Over the years, we've let the police departments do as they please and not politicize them, you know, with a mayor or council overlooking them. And I think that's probably been part of the problem. We need stronger, better civilian oversight. And unfortunately, the police commission does not have enough authority and responsibility, and that's something we're trying to change.
However, it is the tool that people can go to if they have a problem like what the caller said, and that needs to get out into the community. It's not that you have to sit there and do nothing.
No, there not is doing a nothing, recourse. But the idea that even if you call, that it's not going to be terribly effective because there isn't, you know, that sense of authority behind it, or, you know, real teeth in it, as you just talked about a moment ago, Senator.
Well,
that's been part of it, which is why
what people don't
people
realize
don't
is that
to,
the police chief and the police department can overrule and veto anything police commission does in terms of complaints, and that's happened recently.
Which makes the commission reasonably toothless.
Yes, but generally the department does overall take their decisions, but the fact that they have that veto power over the police commission is a problem.
All right, we're going to go back to the phone lines and talk to Renee, who's been waiting patiently from Kauai. Aloha, Renee.
Aloha. I wanted to come back to the conversation regarding racism and really talk about bias when police maybe go into certain neighborhoods that have reputations, and you know, how does that factor into their work? And if we look at the criminal justice system overall, I'm wondering if there's been research as you look into the percentages of certain groups or populations that are there, that shouldn't be, that there's more of one population and not of another, that's really reflective of our entire multicultural community.
Renee,
my second question is about gun violence.
Renee, stop for a second. I want to get your first question answered in the interest of time, because it's coming up toward 6 o'clock, and I want to get the Senator in here.
Great picture. In terms of our general our justice system, we do have an abundance or overpopulation of Native Hawaiians in our prison system. And that's an issue that OHA and other Native Hawaiian groups have looked at in the past, and we're trying to correct that and better that situation and see why is it that the Native population is, you know, in the 20 percentile or so, and yet the population can be 40-50% depending on who you talk to.
And up at the law school, Justin Levinson is doing a lot of work on implicit bias. And that is ongoing. We've been talking to him over time, and now we'll be talking to him again.
And just Aaron, so that the people who are listening to the radio show are clear, when we talk criminal justice system, we're talking three components: the police, the legal system, and corrections. And so when we talk about problems within the criminal justice system, we're not just talking about police. We're also talking about, like the senator just brought up, skewed demographics in terms of corrections, and also skewed demographics in our legal system about who we're prosecuting and who we're not prosecuting.
Right, and going back to the beginning of that, of where that journey starts.
Correct.
Going back to the phone lines, to Ann calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Ann. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. It's Ann Freed. Aloha, Senator. Thank you very much for your help for women. Yes, I didn't hear it early on, but I wanted to hear about, you know, where undergoing an epidemic of violence against women in this country and the world. And HPD, in particular, is no exception to that. They have what would be laughably short amount of training if it wasn't so tragic on domestic violence, for example. And the Commission on the Status of Women, which is my co-chair, has numerous examples of the abuse of power with respect to women and domestic violence and sex assault within HPD and other police department, other county police departments. The senator has worked hard, and I thank him on bringing forth some bills, and I do see some improvement. But what really discouraged me was the unions and the commission standing up there fighting, getting things like body cameras and more and better training. I mean, they get 1 hour a year on domestic violence. That is criminal in and of itself. So I'd like to hear some about that.
All right, fine. And thank you very much for calling. We did talk a bit about domestic violence earlier in the show, so you may want to go back and get the podcast. Anne, thanks very much for the call. I watched you shake your head when she said they get about an hour's worth of training. How much training do you get in domestic violence?
They don't get an hour of training. Actually, there is extensive training in the police department. As a matter of fact, and as far as domestic violence goes, we've actually recently increased the amount of training. We've changed our training. We have a lot of different partnerships with domestic violence advocacy groups like the Domestic Violence Action Center, Hawaii State Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Parent and Children Together Pact, OHIA Domestic Violence. I mean, the list goes on and on. We've also recently introduced the lethal assessment program that when officers go to the a call for domestic violence, they have a tool that they can use, a questionnaire that they can ask the victim to determine whether or not future violence is going to occur and the type of help that they need. So as far as our work in trying to better how we deal with domestic violence victims, you know, I think we're doing our part to make sure that we improve our services.
Yes, and I can say the department is improving, but, you know, up to the Darren Cachola case, it was really weak and poor. And it wasn't until we had legislative hearings and pressure was put on the department that they did start some improvements. And there's certainly a long way to go. And as I'm talking about this, it's, again, not just the PD, but it's all state law enforcement agencies as well, that we need to have better standards and training across the board.
And to really address Anne, I want to assure her that, you know, academics up at the University of Hawaii in the Women's Studies Department are deeply engaged with criminal justice reform, especially Mita Chesney
Lynn. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also Laura Thielen, who's one of the senators that's with the Women's Legislative Caucus that's always been working with Senator Espero on police reform.
And another fact, we need more women leaders in HPD. Of the dozen or so, only one or two are women.
Well, you got double pitches for for being part of the for HPD, but we've got literally about a minute and a half left. I want to go right around the table. If you had one wish for the way that we need to have better relationship between communities and police, what do you think has to change, and how do we do that very quickly tomorrow? Start.
From a researcher's perspective, I would say that the one thing that we need to do nationally is to look to Hawaii. We here have went ahead and made negotiated efforts, and I think we're the model.
And that could be a beacon. Go ahead.
I really want to see a standards and training board passed and look at the officers that we are recruiting and training and working with.
And Captain Vanek, yeah,
I think
seconds.
we need to continue to strengthen our community partnerships, because like I said before, the police can't do it by themselves. We really need those partnerships with the community to help with their safety as well.
Captain Roddy Vanek, thank you for being here. Aaron Hunger, and to Senator Willis Sparrow,
thank you
for joining us. We'll talk again. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'll see you tomorrow morning right back here for the conversation. Meanwhile, have yourselves a good evening. Aloha.